All right, I'll just say it again. I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date's July 14th, 2002. As Nina said, I'm a member of the New Day group in Virginia Beach. Pretty much until since I was about 6 or 8 months sober, I've been a member there. I want to thank Ralph for asking me to speak tonight. I miss Steve Roach and not being here. I dressed for him.
Remind us to take a picture before you
go. I've spoken for him a few times, and there was always a dress code. I didn't get one for tonight, so I assumed it hadn't changed. So anyway, I'm grateful to be here. I appreciate y'all being here. Many of you have heard this. I've spoken here, I think, 3 times. So if you want to scoot out, that's fine. It's not going to change. I only got one story, but I'm going to tell it. And I'm really grateful to be here and really grateful to be sober. I didn't think I was capable of living the life I get to live today. You know, through Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles I've learned in here and the people I've met, you know, and a lot of people outside of AA that helped me and helped me get here and loved me when I wasn't very lovable, you know. I had my first drink at 8 years old. Me and a couple of cousins, we stole it out of a cooler, a little family get-together, you know. It was a Rolling Rock. That ought to tell you something, because I can't tell you who my third grade teacher was, but I can tell you that was a Rolling Rock. I remember it like it was yesterday. We snuck in the backyard, and, you know, it was only an 8-ounce pony, like the Rolling Rocks, and we passed it around. So I didn't get drunk, but I immediately liked the way it made me feel. You know, because I was the youngest of 4 kids. I always felt like I got jilted. They got to stay up later and go out later and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I was thinking about me. I didn't know it at the time, but it was self-centeredness. And that beer made me feel older and cooler and all the things I wanted to feel, you know. And I didn't pick up again until I was probably 12 or 13. But about that age, I started to drink pretty much every weekend. We'd steal a little out of the parents' liquor cabinet or get some beers out of the garage refrigerator. I snuck through some doggy doors. I was a lot smaller then. And got some out of the neighbor's garage refrigerator a couple of times. Plus, the drinking age was 18. You could get an older brother to get it. There was myriad of ways. I got my first fake ID at 14 out of the back of the Rolling Stone. You know, and it worked at stores back then. And, you know, it said Virginia on it, but it didn't look all that official, but it worked. So I liked drinking. I liked what it did for me. It seemed to be, you know, I had a lot of friends back then. It seemed to bring us closer together. A lot of those guys are still some of my best friends. We lost one or two along the way to alcoholism. Most of them aren't alcoholics, but we used to drink a lot together. We used to go to I lived across the street from elementary school, and the ball fields were over there, and we would go over there drinking and spin around, trying to get dizzy and drunk, you know, and run from the cops and all that good stuff, yeah. And it was fun, but, you know, at some level, I already knew that, you know, I was lying to cover it up. I was doing things I was taught not to do. You know, my mother was a strict disciplinarian. She wore the pants in the family. She enforced the rules with this rod she used to poke the laundry down with, you know. I don't think it was a broken broomstick or something, or go get a switch. That was another one. So I just learned how to not tell her, you know, how to get away with stuff, basically. And I get caught every 5 or 6 times. But I would say, well, that's pretty good. You know, I got away with it several other times. But yeah, I could already tell. And, you know, this was in the 70s, early 70s, mid 70s, but the war had been going on, Vietnam, and there was a lot of drug abuse both there and in the States. And I thought, I'll never do drugs. And I'm not gonna talk about it much, but when somebody handed me a joint, boom, I just hit it. You know, I didn't think twice. And that's kind of where I went, you know. So I was lucky that I was good in school. God gave me a brain. I didn't really have to try that hard. And I was pretty good at sports, played a number of sports. And you know, so I didn't really, I guess I felt left out in a way sometimes, or different. You know, you hear a lot of people say how they felt different, but I just wanted to be part of every group. I didn't want to be left out of anything, you know. I was a jock, a brain, a head, all of that, you know. And yeah, I didn't like to be left out of anything. So I liked being vice president of things, because, you know, vice president's a great title, but the secretary, treasurer, and president do everything. So I was vice president of like the class, the SCA, whatever. But we had this thing called the Key Club, which was basically a high school fraternity. It was a service organization with the Kiwanis, but you used to get kegs, you know, and I was president of that, because the president got to buy the kegs and, you know, do all that fun stuff. And I remember our money was in the bank with Charlottesville High School, it's where I grew up, and I wrote a check from Charlottesville High School for 4 kegs when I was 16. At the Estes IGA. Yeah, it was just different back then, I guess, different times. So anyway, my mother got sick during that time. She got cancer. She went in remission for a while, and then it came back. She ended up dying when I was a senior in high school, 17. And that's something I can point to, is really knowing that that I was self-centered. I can look at it now and see it, because I did not know how to act. I did not know what to say. And I was thinking about all that, about me, and our family didn't talk about that kind of stuff. So I was not, you know, even though she'd been sick, I'd been to the hospital 1,000 times when it actually happened, and all my friends came over after the funeral and all that stuff. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, and I was sure wasn't going to ask anybody, you know. But I do, you know, and she was, like I said, she was kind of the disciplinarian. She took me to church until I was about 13, and I went to some class. It was a Methodist church, and I became a member. And at that point, she said, "You don't have to go anymore if you don't want to. It's up to you now." And I didn't go anymore, because I wanted to be with my friends, you know. I wanted to be out on the playground. And I was already breaking the rules. So anyway, when she died, it's no excuse, but I definitely kicked it into another gear. I was agnostic. I didn't really believe in all that God stuff, because if I did, that meant I was going when you know where. And I didn't know you could have a personal relationship with a power greater than myself. Yeah, I learned that here. But anyway, she was gone. I didn't really have anybody to answer to, and yeah, just kicked it into another gear. She did have a rule that you were going to go to college and pay your own way, everybody in the family. So I started working. I took the family paper out over when I was 8. And when I wanted to play football in my freshman year of high school, she said, "Well, you got to get a job if you give up the paper out." So I worked all through that, and I saved money. And I got into a few colleges, being from Charlottesville, I ended up going to UVA. And I got into some probably better schools. I mean, that's a great school. But if you'd asked me, I'd say, well, it's the best education for the money. But the truth is, I went there because that's where my buddies were still in Charlottesville. I had people I drank with there. I was going from being a big fish in a little pond to being a little fish in a big pond. And I wanted that fallback plan, you know? And I did, and I met people in college, and one guy in particular I'll talk about later lived on my hall first year. But, you know, I did not realize that fear ran my life so much back then. I can see it all clearly now, but I was scared to go off by myself. And drinking was right there too, you know. All my decisions, really, most of my life, up till I got here, were based on alcohol, where I lived, where I worked, who I hung out with, you know, how I spent my money, because most of my money went to that. So I ended up in places that weren't that nice to live. I ended up I got fired from a couple of jobs. I didn't work for a while. So anyway, I went to UVA. I remember first year, this guy across the hall, first guy ever said it to me, said, "Do you think you drink a little too much?" I said, "What a nerd, you know? You know, we're the cool people, you know, he's missing out." And because I, you know, because God gave me this brain, I'd taken a lot of the courses in high school. They didn't have AP where I went. I don't even know if they had it back then. This was in the 70s. So I took a lot of classes I'd already had. I did go into an engineering school because I was good at math. I didn't really want to be a civil engineer, mechanical, or any of that. But I figured I'm good at math, I probably should go into engineering. But so first year, I had like a 3.0, 3.2, something like that. And I did, you know, I said, "Man, this is easy." Yeah. So second year, my roommate and I, who was from Charlottesville, we roomed together first year because we didn't want to take a chance on getting somebody we didn't know, you know. And anyway, we got a place off campus, and second semester, second year, we had a combined 1.02 grade point there. And I had a 0.82, I was very proud of myself. And I had enough of a good grades the first year that I was able to, I was still over a 2.0. They asked him to take a break. He never went back. He became president of a general contractor firm that builds buildings at UVA, not an alcoholic. Just that he was a heavy drinker then, you know. And myself, they sent my grades to my dad, who, he was just a big teddy bear. I loved him. We were very close because he and I were together. Well, everybody, all my brothers and sisters had left town as soon as they could, basically. And so just me and him there when my mom was sick and then when she passed. And then he moved away. They had grown up in Charlottesville too, and he couldn't stand living there anymore without her. So we were at my grandfather's one day, and he pulled out of the trunk, he pulls this envelope from UVA with my grades. And I was like, I got a resentment, you know, I'm paying my way. Why are they sending my grades to him? Yeah. And he said, "Dave, you got an F in math. You're so good at math. How'd you do that?" And I was honest. I said, "Dad, it was at 8 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't make it. It was too early." Yeah. But he said he was disappointed in me. And you could yell at me and beat me and all that, and I wasn't going to do anything. But I loved him, and he told me he was disappointed in me, and I did want to do better. So I started going to class. It was a lot easier going to class. And I didn't drink any less, but I went to class. I knew what the professors expected. I took a computer course and I said, "Hey, I like this." And I ended up going into computer science and engineering school back in, this was around 80 when the first microcomputers were coming out. It was a good time. And you know, I did a lot of projects in the middle of the night in the computer lab with other guys that brought a six pack with them, you know, my people. And but I did very well the last 2 years because I'd found what worked for me in that realm. I started dating a woman that grew up in Charlottesville, actually, and a sister of a friend of mine. And she was going to BU, and her father died in a car wreck. And she ended up coming back and went to UVA. And we were together and lived together most of 7 or 8 years. And I was totally incapable of forming a true partnership with another human being, you know. She would ask me, "What are you thinking? What are you feeling?" And this white noise would go off in my head because I really didn't know. And I never thought that much about that stuff. And I did not know how to take an inventory, that's for sure. You know, I didn't want to talk about feelings. We didn't talk about feelings in my house, yeah. And it would just, and so I was a very poor communicator. And she liked to drink too. And so it was, we loved each other, but drinking and partying was what it was based on, really. And I ended up graduating there, and I got a, guess what? I got a job in Charlottesville. Yeah. My last year, I actually worked, I got a summer job before my last year, and then at an engineering place, Sperry Marine. doing radars and collision avoidance and stuff, and I ended up staying on there when, you know, I graduated. And so now I had my boys I grew up with, some guys I'd met in college, and people at work, you know. I had parties, I had people to party with everywhere, you know, bowling league, whatever. And so a few years later, you know, she left, and it was, you know, she found somebody else, but then she came back and said, I really want to be here. And I told her, no, don't come back. And I did have enough sense to know that I could not be the person that she needed, you know. And about 2 years later, I got one DUI at 19, my first one. And I went to the VASAP class. I went to one AA meeting. And I said, y'all talking about drinking, you know, and I didn't want any part of that. I'm too young and too good looking to be an alcoholic. And I've got jobs and school and girlfriend. So I just signed a sheet for the rest of them to go back. And then I got another one at 26 that came with some contraband charges. And I did go to VASAP. I didn't remember that until a guy in AA that I knew back then said, you remember when we had Coach Elder for VASAP? Oh, I mean, I swear, I thought I didn't even go the second time, but I did. Anyway, she left, and then a couple years later, she got sober. And she's still sober today, so she's been sober close to 40 years, in the mid-30s anyway, maybe more. She sent me this letter a few months after she went away, and it had this book in it, too. It was Living Sober. Great book. I love it now, but I was like, Living Sober? Who wants to do that? You know? And I just threw it in the junk drawer with all the bills, yeah, that I never paid. And there was a nice letter, and I don't really remember what it said, but I know now it was an amends letter. And a couple months later, I got another one. This one had Came to Believe in it, another AA classic. Came to Believe in what? Why did she send me this stuff? Yeah. I really had no clue. I mean, I knew really, again, deep down, that what I was doing was wrong, and that I was sad and lonely and miserable inside, but I just kept drinking it away, just covering it, you know. And I felt like I couldn't ever admit that I was an alcoholic, because I'd kind of based my whole life on living that way, yeah. So at that time, I ended up with the contraband charges, getting pre-conviction probation, which meant I went to the parole officer for a year, gave my sample, and it was I got null process if I passed all of them, and I passed them all. And but you know, I just, when it was over, I just went right back to what I was doing. And but during that time, I started a business at night with a guy I'd gone to college with, that we sat in the back of the class together, so we did a lot of projects together, you know. And he was very bright, but you know, the main reason I went and started this business with him was a software business. Anybody remember WordPerfect and WordStar? There's a few old relics like me in here. We had the number one add-on for that. We did it at night. You know, people were getting rich doing software, and I would have told you that's why I was doing it, but the real reason I was doing it is to set my own hours. Because my job started at 7:30, and I hated that. I was out till 1 or 2 every night, pretty much. And so I went into business with this guy so that I could set my own hours, and it got later and later and later over the years. But that's when we moved to Virginia Beach. His wife was a doctor, didn't want to work at UVA, so they offered me Richmond, Northern Virginia, or Virginia Beach. No brainer, I'm going to the beach, you know. We used to come here all the time as a kid. That fellow I talked about that lived on my hall first year, not the one that said, are you think you're drinking too much? But the one who was kind of he was a friend of ours, a good friend. And he lived down here, so we moved down here, we brought the business down here. I loved living at the beach, but yeah, I that was the one time I remember thinking, I'm going to slow down. You know, I'm moving away. I'm going to get away from all those people who always call, you know, the guys who are married and call me up when their wives give them a pass for the night. I was going to go out anyway, but yeah, I was able to blame them, right? Anyway, I thought I'm going to slow down when I get down there. And within a week, I was back at it. You know, I had a new bar, a new group of people. And yeah, same old thing. Different day, same thing. Different place, same thing. And I got two more DUIs during the next 8 or 9 years. But you know, they didn't have those laws about multiple ones until towards the end, and they were spaced out enough that I did probably 7 or 8, 9 single nights in jail. And I did a week on work release where I didn't have to go into jail. I went to a place and they sent us out to do something. You know, I say that casually, but nobody else in my family went to jail. You know, how was I able, I was able to just slough it off, right? They didn't get arrested. And again, you know, at this point, I'm in bad shape. I mean, there's just no doubt. That people that love me still, but that couldn't be around me. No, and I didn't really want to be around them because I didn't want them seeing me in that condition. And the business went under. Windows kind of took our niche. So in like 97, 98, we ended that. And then I spent about 2 years on the couch. I had a little hovel apartment out on the north end at the beach. And yeah, I didn't work. I didn't really have any money. Somehow I scraped by helping out people on the block. I did get a job at that, I think it's a Westin now, it was a Ramada Plaza Resort Hotel out there like 57th Street. Because my dad ran hotels, I'd worked in hotels. I got the night auditor's job, perfect job for an alcoholic. And, nobody around, got free access to the bar and food. And I was there until the weekend of Y2K, and I worked Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, then New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, and I felt like I was entitled to borrow the deposit for a few days after that, and so I borrowed the deposit for a few days, and when Monday came around, I was doing some consulting work on putting in a network for the guy I mentioned earlier that lived on my hall and lived in Virginia Beach. And I went there and they paid me for what I'd done so far and I was able to take the money in. I got fired and I'm grateful they didn't call the police on me. You know, so I'm telling you all this. I tell you about my arrest, my brushes with AA to tell you that God gave me a lot of signs and he let me go as far as I needed to go. I was very thick-headed, you know. I was always an obstinate guy. And you know, bam, bam, just kept putting it in my face, and I just kept ignoring it or drinking it away, whatever. And so finally, after I got fired from there, a couple months later, there's a knock at my door. And it's the fellow that I went to college with that lived on our hall. He actually lived across the street. We were good buddies. I partied with his wife a lot. He was a little more of a businessman at that point, but she liked to party. Anyway, he said he wouldn't come in because he knew what it was like inside. Not many people crossed the threshold in my place back then. I mean, it was nasty. Anyway, he said, look, I'll give you a job and pay your electric bill because the electricity was off. If you'll go to one meeting with a mutual friend of ours. And this guy was in NA. I knew him well. We had partied hard until he came in 7 years before I did. So he had about 5 years at that point. This was 2000. And so even I could do that math, you know. I'm going to get a job and get my electricity on for an hour. You know, I'll do that, sure. So I went to my second meeting. And there's the other fellowship with my buddy, who's still a really good friend of mine. We play golf every Sunday. But he took me to that meeting, and they did all these readings. I don't know if y'all have been there, but I said, afterwards on the way home, I said, you know, I have a problem with all of that. Alcohol is not my problem. What's the problem with that? I think I've qualified as an alcoholic here tonight, but I was keeping that in my back pocket, you know. And I said, I'm just going to stop doing all that. And he looked at me and he goes, well, okay. He was good. He didn't fight me. He didn't try to tell me I was wrong. But he called me the next day and he said, look, I talked to about five people that have a lot more time than me. And they said, there's almost no chance you can do that. I said, watch me, you know. And I got my first paycheck and I'm off to the races again. And I start stealing from the company that I go to work for, my buddy's company. We make hip-hop clothing. I work for a hip-hop fashion company. And I was able to take those clothes and trade them for cash or other things that I liked. And, you know, and I got caught a couple of times, or I know that people saw me, but I guess he took care of it. So, about 2 years later, July 13th, 2002, I went to see Dave Matthews at the amphitheater. And I grew up with a couple of those guys, the drummer and I played football together. And I went with my boss, my friend, and my old college roommate, because he lived on the hall with this guy. Yeah, we were all buddies. And he came down and we went to the show together. And my last beer, I didn't know it at the time, was on the drummer's bus. And then they took me home to a seedy hotel, the Lake Motel in Virginia Beach. At that point, I was telling Ralph this on the way out. I'd get an apartment, pay first and last month rent in like April, and then I could squeeze it out until about September without paying. Then they'd kick me out. Then I'd go to the oceanfront. You could get a room for like $150 a week, and I'd do that all winter until, you know, the prices went up. I thought I was smart. It was just such a lonely, miserable existence. Anyway, the next morning I go to work, he comes in. I'm now have sequestered myself into a far away room in the warehouse, I didn't like people seeing me, and I slept in the bathroom here and there. He came in the office and said, "Look, you've been stealing from us, and I can't cover you anymore. I got partners, you know. I gotta let you go." And my stomach hit the floor. I was terrified. And I'd been fired before. It didn't really bother me. But this time I knew this was the last house on the block. I couldn't con or manipulate anybody else. I had nowhere to go. There was a padlock on the door at the hotel. I couldn't get in until I paid them again. And I was terrified, and I just didn't know what was going to happen. And on the way out the door, he turned around with this little sparkle in his eye and said, "Do you want to go to treatment now?" Now, because he had offered several times in the past. And it was almost an out-of-body experience. I saw myself going, yes. And I wanted to grab it and stuff it back in my mouth, you know, but it was already out there. I couldn't do it. But there was some relief in that, too, at that point. And actually, one of the other partners came up, and he said, "All right, you stay here. I'll see what I can do." And one of the other partners came over. Turns out he was in N.A., had been for 10 years, and did just a little bit of 12-step talk with me. And, tiny bit more relief knowing I wasn't alone. So that night, I didn't have anywhere to go because I couldn't get in the hotel room. I didn't have any money. I'm the last one in the office, and the lights are on. You know, my mind is racing, and it's a mess. This had been for years. And I start thinking, you know, the cops are going to drive by here and see me and think I'm breaking into the place. Yeah, I can't stay here. So I went out and slept in the woods behind the building. Yeah. And I know now I needed that. I mean, I've been what I call functionally homeless for a long time. I told you how I did it. But that night I slept in the woods, and I go back there every year on my anniversary to remind myself. But the next day he came in, he goes, "Where did you stay last night?" And I said, "Under that tree over there." And he said, "All right, tonight you stay with me, and then we'll go up to Williamsburg tomorrow." And so the next day, Wednesday, I go to work, and he actually, we went around the warehouse, and he picked a few clothes out and gave to me so I'd have something clean and decent to wear. And on the way up there, you know, I'm starting to feel pretty good. It's been a couple of days since I've drank, you know, and I'm thinking maybe I was a little hasty, you know? Like, and then I said, "How long am I going to be up here?" He said, "Well, they got a 5-day evaluation period." I said, "Oh, I can do 5 days. You know, three hots and a cot, get some rest and come back and drink like a gentleman." This was all in my head. I didn't say that. I get there and the doctor comes in, and for whatever reason, I'm honest with her and I tell her what everything I'm doing. And she goes, her hair didn't catch on fire or any of that, but she said, "I'm going to recommend you stay 3 months. "Hello! Don't y'all have like a 28-day program?" You know, I'm going to negotiate at this point. And she said, "Sure, we can start with that." So, all right. So I'm in, you know. I get a room and with another guy. And they take me to my first little session that evening, and it's the patients, there's like 10 of us and a counselor, and they're reading the big book. I was going around reading the big book, which I didn't know what it was. But it just so happened they had read all the way around the first 164, and they wanted the doctor's opinion. And we read that night, and I said, "Wow." I was in a state where I could hear it, and I said, "Wow, I'm an alcoholic." Who knew? Yeah, everybody knew but me. But once I heard it laid out in that fashion, and once I start, I can't stop. When I'm stopped, I'm talking myself into it or figuring out how I'm going to do it again, whatever. Yeah, I said, "That's me. Since I first started drinking regularly, I've been like that. You know, back when I was 12 or 13, all week long, it was about how we're going to get it, where we're going to do it, all that." So we went to a meeting. They took us to a meeting. I got my white chip, and so far, that's the only one. A couple weeks in, we were out back swapping war stories. The nurse came out and said, "It's 2 a.m, go to bed." And I was like, "Who?" Yeah. At this point, my emotions are starting to bubble to the surface and I got really angry. Yeah, I'm a grown man. Who's she to tell what to do? Tell her to go to bed. Yeah, I'm in the asylum, but I'm a grown man. But I went to bed and I was angry and I said the serenity prayer over and over because that's all I had. And I woke up and did the same thing. And I went out on the porch, and this fellow that had been there almost 3 months, he was an old timer. He talked to me. It took him about an hour to convince me that under that anger was fear. And I was fear of giving up. I was scared of giving up control. And once I processed that, I said, "You know, I haven't done a very good job of being in control. Look where I am. You know, look how I'm living." And so then, I'd taken the first step, I think, when we read the doctor's opinion that night. But now I'm kind of stuck at step two a little bit. So I did, I didn't know how I was going to wrestle with this God thing. So I did a flow chart on the existence of God in my big book. And because I'm a computer guy, I did a flow chart. And I started with, like, there's no proof there's God. If I let it go, where do it go? And it's still in my book. It's in pencil, but you can still make it out. And basically it ended with, there's no proof there isn't. And today I see proof everywhere, all around this room, outside, driving down the street. I see proof. But then that was just enough to get me started. And I started trying to pray. I stole my first sponsor. Like I did everything. I was walking down the hall, there was a guy on the phone. I said, "Who are you talking to?" He said, "My sponsor." And I grabbed the phone from him. I didn't know who the guy was. I said, "Hey, will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Yeah, call me every night at 10. Every night? Isn't that a little excessive? I didn't say that, but that's what I'm thinking. I didn't have a phone in years. It was always bad news. But I did it because in this situation, fear helped me because I was scared to ask anybody else. So I did what he suggested that I do. But he was great. He helped me so much. We did some formal work on steps 1 and 2. We met for dinner once a week. I saw him at a lot of the meetings. I kept in touch with him for years afterwards until he passed away. But and then I also decided to stay 3 months. I said, I'm here. I don't want to come back. I might as well do the whole bid. And called my friend, my boss, and said, I think I want to stay for 3 months. He said, stay as long as you need to. Him and my brother and the founding partner paid my way through there. It was not cheap. Now, I talked with him recently last time I spoke. Because, a lot of my friends were telling him he was enabling me. I hate that word. I think it's we're trying to blame the wrong people. He was loving me. He was keeping me alive long enough that I got to a point where I would accept help. I believe that. He loved me as long as it took until I was willing to accept help. And I told him that again about 3 weeks ago. He said, you've more than made up for it. I said, that's not really what I'm looking for. I just want to let you know what you mean to me. Anyway, so I can't, I didn't know where I was going to come back to. He wanted to rent me a single apartment by myself. Even I knew that was a bad idea. The counselor said, they got some Oxford houses down there. And so for the last week, I called every night, no beds. The night before I got out, a bed opened up. And I got into the Oxford house. Stuff was happening. I was getting out of the way. I was thinking, working on staying sober and doing the things that were suggested. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I had a couple of instances of real terror while I was in treatment. They made you come home for a weekend. And I took the bus, and that fellow that took me to my second meeting, the guy from NA I play golf with, he was going to pick me up at the bus station. But I knew I could get off anywhere along the way. And that scared me. And I prayed and I prayed, and we crested a hill on 264, and the sun came in, and I just felt this warmth. And it was a spiritual experience, not an awakening, but I had a lot of these little spiritual experiences and lots of new ideas popping into my head that weren't me. So anyway, I ended up in the Oxford house. I hadn't had a car or license, I don't know how long, years. I decided I would go to DMV and see what when I could get a license and what it was going to cost and if I had to do any time or anything. And the lady looked it up. I told her my story. She looked it up and she said, you were eligible to get your license back on October 4th. That was the day I got out of treatment. It took 5 weeks to get all the paperwork right because it was right after 9/11 and things were pretty tight, but I had to make my first amends to some banks for bounced checks because you had to have a bank statement to get a driver's license. So I got to do that. And my sister gave me an old beater. And I'm taking a walk one day right after that. And that's my way I meditate, is exercise and walking. I'm not real good at the sitting down and trying to do it that way. If I do something physical, that clears my mind and think ideas can pop in my head. Anyway, I'm walking and what I'm thinking is, I got this car, maybe I'll go see my old girl in Ocean View. Yeah. Anybody know Ocean View? Yeah. I swear to God, it almost knocked me down. This idea came out of right field. You should use that car to take somebody to a meeting. And the next day I met a guy at New Day. It might have been before you, Ralph. He was the punter for Wyoming at one time. But anyway, he was new. He couldn't drive. I picked him up every day for a year. He kept me sober that year. I had to play. I had a job to do. Get him to the meeting. They also, at 6 months, made me the treasurer at New Day. I'm a thief. And we have, at that point, we only had two, we started a second meeting, I think, around that time. Two meetings a day. That's still a lot of money. But it was your money. It was AA, their money. I cared about it. I wasn't, and I learned how to balance a checkbook. I think I've told you a couple of times how good I am at math. I had never balanced my checkbook in my life. Because if I had checks, I had money. That's the way I like to think. That's why I had to make those amends at the banks. But so anyway, that started me on a long journey of service. That, you know, next to my first pass through the 12 steps, it gave me more growth than anything else in AA. The relationships and the working with people and working for the greater good, you know. It's been wonderful. I got a sponsor in Virginia Beach. He kept asking me when I was going to do my fourth step. Well, I thought I kind of neatly evaded that somehow. I hadn't really done the third step, is what it turns out. And I was about 6 months sober. I had that car, and I was starting to think about drinking, because I was starting to think about all of those dirty, nasty, rotten things I'd done and needed to be on that fourth step. They're all swimming in my head, which is not a good place for that stuff. And I knew that a drink would temporarily take that away. And I could taste it. I left my second meeting of the day. I called my sponsor. It was about 9 o'clock, and I came to a T intersection, and my bar was a mile one way, and my Oxford house was a mile the other way. And I said, God, please get me home tonight. And I abandoned myself to God in that moment, you know, which I had prayed and had those other little experiences, but this time I didn't, there was nobody else to ask. If I told somebody outside of AA that story, they would say, you just decided to take a left. I did not, you know. God gave me the strength and the courage to go left. You know, all I know is the next day when I woke up, I knew what to do, and I went to the library and started writing my fourth step. Yeah. And I did my fifth step in the kitchen at the church where I went to a lot of meetings. We did 6, 7, boom, boom. I will always be working on 6 and 7. I had a long list on my 8th step, lots of former girlfriends, former landlords, former employers, all my family. But I made a lot of them, and I made them, you know, face to face, the ones I could. I still, every so often, I'll think of somebody, and then you have to decide whether it would hurt them more, especially if it was a relationship or something like that. You know, my partner in that business that I told you I didn't really like that much. And I thought he was stealing from me and not giving me my due when I was working with him. It took me probably 5 or 6 years to sit down with him. And when I did, and I told him, you know, I made the amends and told him what I'd done wrong and what I was doing so it wouldn't happen again, and asked if I could do anything to make it right with him. He said, it wasn't that bad. Well, you fired me once, and then you took me back. It was bad. I was there. But anyway. Yeah, some people was like that. Other people said, I'm really happy for you. I don't want to see you again. Yeah, there weren't many of those, but there were a couple. Let's see. So, you know, somebody last time I spoke said I didn't talk any about my relationships. Now, I've never been married. I don't have any children. I do have great relationships with my family of origin, better than they've ever been. We say, I love you now. Nobody did that in my family, but I started doing it. Now, you know, people are doing it back. And I have 8 nieces and nephews and 8 grandnieces and nephews, and I love them all to death, and they tell me they love me. I've dated a few women in AA, the relationships were much better. They did end, but they ended much better. And but I've been dating a lady, that lives in the condo where I live. Not an alcoholic, doesn't really drink, but I moved in there 6 years ago, and we parked next to each other. And she'd be sitting in her car, and I'd back in, and we'd start talking through the window. And then one night I saw her going out on a date, and I opened the door for her and said, have fun. And next time I saw her, I said, how'd the date go? She goes, not very well, but you make me laugh. I don't know what your deal is, but if you want to go out sometime, we can do that. She gave me her card. And I said, well, my deal is I am seeing somebody, but I don't think it's going to last much longer. And then I lost her card. I showed my friends, and then I lost her card. And I didn't see her in the parking lot for a while. And so Thanksgiving, it'll be 6 years this Thanksgiving, she called me. I was in Charlottesville with my family, but And we went out that Saturday night, and we've been going out ever since. I will tell you, one of the secrets of that relationship is we each have our own condo. We're in the same building, but it works out pretty well. You know, now, at some point, we'll both, you know, she's a personal trainer, and she does, you know, she works some. I'm still full-time at work. If I retire someday, that may change, but for right now, we each got our own place. Yeah, who knows? But she doesn't want to get married, and I'm fine with that. She's been married. She's done all that. I have friends, a lot of them here tonight, that, you know, we connect on a level. I have really good friends from the old days, and I connect with them, but not the way we do here, because we came here with this common problem. We stayed here because of the common solution, you know, and we can talk about things that, I mean, I remember when I was telling my, doing my fifth step with my sponsor, telling him stuff I never thought I'd tell anybody, you know. But the relief and of getting that out and getting it off my chest and realizing I'm not alone and that I'm not the only one that's done it, you know, because they got a name for it, you know. I mean, somebody else did it. So I think that's about it. Am I close?
You're good.
All right. I'll just always wrap up with, you know, being a math guy. I got so much more out of this than I put into it, and anybody I talk to that's been around a while would say the same thing. So if you add it all up, where does all that extra come from? And I think it comes from your higher power and your higher power and my higher power. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much, David, for sharing your story with us.
Thanks.
All right, where am I? Okay, our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Thank you. Money collected at this meeting covers donation to the church and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, and the General Services. All right, are there any AA-related announcements tonight? Yes, sir.
I think we've got a flyer up there. In the,
I'm sure we do. I didn't even think
to look. Grad student dinner we're doing.
Yes, yeah. We are gonna. We're having a gratitude dinner here on November the 14th, and it's going to be on experience, strength, and hope. And we have three speakers: Shonda G, Carlos R, and Shelley H. Thank you. So that will be on the 14th. It starts at 6:30 with dinner. And we have a pretty good dinner, so great desserts. Okay, and then we will start the workshop at 7:30, and it'll run till 9. And there will be an Ask It basket. And I think that's the only one we have up here. Does anybody else have anything else?
We'll yes, be sir. Open a new day all day Thanksgiving Day.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Great.
6 in the morning till 10:30 at night. Yeah. Food, fellowship meetings every hour and a half.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. All right, where am I? And I have asked a friend, Jake, if he would do chips for us tonight.
David, thank you so much for that talk. I picture you going to rehab wearing hip-hop clothes.
I'm warm 7 years, everybody got it.
Thank you for sharing your story. I've heard it, I think that's my fourth time hearing it, and I get something new every time. And your presence in AA is awesome to see. So appreciate you. Chips, we've got the white chip. This is the 24-hour chip. And this is for anybody who has had some issues with their drinking. They have a desire to stop drinking for the next 24 hours. Would somebody like to come up, pick up a chip, and commit to try and stay sober for the next 24 hours? All right. Does anybody have 30 days of continuous sobriety? Anybody got 60 days? 90 days? 6 months? 9 months. And this one is for 1 year or more from another home group. Any surprise birthdays? Mm-hmm. And then our home group members, we hand out these heavy medallions, a little jingle in your pocket to remind you to stay sober, maybe. One last call to commit for another 24 hours to stay sober. All right, thanks for letting me chip.
Thank you.